From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We were optimistic when Hamas agreed to the ceasefire proposal. We were very optimistic. But Israel procrastinated, and it is going too far. They don't want to agree for ceasefire, and they want to raid Rafah.
There has been a response from Hamas to the hostage deal. We're currently reviewing that response, and we're discussing it with our partners in the region.
Even after Hamas accepted a Gaza ceasefire proposal Monday, Israeli forces moved in with tanks to seize the Rafah crossing with Egypt. Israel says the ceasefire deal falls short of its demands. Hamas has called for international intervention. We'll go to Rafah for reaction, and we'll get an update from the former Israeli peace negotiator, Daniel Levy. Then, more than 50 chapters of the American Association of Professors condemned the violent arrest by police responding to peaceful pro-Palestinian campus protests.
Leave our students alone!
With Dartmouth professor, former chair of Jewish studies there, Annalise Orlach, who says police body slammed her to the ground as she tried to protect her students. She was charged with criminal trespass and temporarily banned from portions of Dartmouth's campus. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinians in Rafah say they're trapped as Israeli tanks have taken over the crossing on Gaza's border with Egypt. The United Nations says Israel's denying access to the southern Gaza Strip through the Rafah crossing as aid groups warn of impending catastrophe amidst chaotic scenes of families fleeing with no safe option for shelter. The area came under heavy aerial bombardment again overnight as Israel vowed to continue its attacks on Rafah even after Hamas said it had accepted a ceasefire proposal advanced by Qatari and Egyptian mediators Monday. Israel rejected the ceasefire but said it would send a delegation to Cairo for further talks. We'll go to Rafah later in the broadcast to get the latest from Palestinian journalist Akram Al-Satari. A Guardian investigation found Israel used a U.S.-made weapon in the March 27th airstrike that killed seven emergency health workers in southern Lebanon. Rights groups say the attack was a violation of international law. Gaza solidarity protests continue at college campuses across the United States, as does the police crackdown. On Monday, 43 arrests were reported at UCLA. At the University of California, San Diego, video shows a crowd of student protesters blocking a police bus from leaving with arrested students. This comes after UC Riverside protesters announced Friday it has become the first UC campus to reach a deal with the school to start evaluating its ties with Israel. At Harvard, students and faculty rallied Monday after the administration threatened mass expulsions for hundreds of arrested protesters. This is Issa, a Palestinian student at Harvard who's lost over 120 family members in Gaza.
Over the last 6 months, more than 124 people in my family have been brutally killed by the Israeli occupation forces.
Shame!
Harvard professor Walter Johnson spoke to students in solidarity with their protest.
There's no room for a reasoned discussion about this action if Harvard will not disclose its investments in the occupied territories, in the Israeli military, and in Gaza.
Nearby, students from a dozen high schools in the Boston area joined the MIT protest Monday, as students there also defied a deadline to clear their encampment. Students at SUNY Purchase here in New York State celebrated late Monday as Gaza solidarity activists announced the school had met protesters' demands, quote, to disclose and cut ties with war crimes and genocide, unquote. Here in New York City, Columbia's canceled its main university-wide graduation ceremony May 15th amid mounting fallout from its mishandling of this protests. Students across New York and other protesters marched through city streets Monday, culminating in a rally near the glitzy, celebrity-filled Met Gala ceremony, where they were met with a heavy police presence. Student protests and encampments are continuing to spread around the globe as well, including in Denmark, where students have occupied Copenhagen University. In Spain, students at Barcelona University are also demanding their school divest from Israel.
We want to firmly condemn the genocide that is happening right now. And we believe that as Western people and Western young people, we have a privilege that we have to put at the service of the people who do not have a voice.
In France, high school students have started to join in the protest movement, organizing strikes and demonstrations. In Belgium, over 100 students have begun a peaceful occupation at Ghent University, demanding the school sever ties with companies connected to Israel's military and enact urgent actions to deal with the climate crisis. In related news, at least 132 climate activists were arrested Saturday in a peaceful blockade, calling on European governments to declare a climate emergency and end fossil fuel subsidies. Many of the activists glued themselves to the ground. The group Extinction Rebellion denounced excessive police violence against protesters, describing police actions as illegal and authoritarian. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 12 people, including children, were killed in two bomb attacks on camps for internally displaced communities near the city of Goma. Congolese and U.S. authorities blamed the bombings on Rwandan forces and the M23 armed group. Rwanda has refuted the accusations, saying the assaults were likely carried out by militias backed by the Congolese army. Intensifying violence in eastern DRC has forced hundreds of thousands to flee. The UN described the attacks as a, quote, flagrant violation of human rights and international humanitarian law, which may constitute a war crime, unquote. In Chad, voters went to the polls Monday in the Sahel region's first election since a wave of coups in recent years. Chad's current leader, President Mohamed Idriss Deby, is largely expected to win. He took power after his long-ruling father, Idriss Deby, was killed on the battlefield in 2021. 10 candidates were disqualified from the election, leading to a call to boycott the polls. Critics and opposition politicians have blasted what they call the dynastic dictatorship. Voters say they want a leader who can improve the dire economic situation in Chad and guarantee peace.
We need peace. We've suffered enough in this country. We want to change. We really want to change. Someone who can lead the country, who won't have the conscience to ignore the suffering of Chadian youth. Chadian youth are suffering. Our parents send us to school and we come back to fight in the neighborhoods. We're fed up. There has to be a change.
Chad is also home to over 1 million refugees, many of them from neighboring Sudan. The election results will take several weeks to be announced. In Moscow, Vladimir Putin was sworn in today for his fifth term as Russian president. Officials from the U.S. and many European Union nations were absent from the lavish Kremlin ceremony. This comes a day after Russia said it will conduct missile drills near Ukraine for the possible use of tactical nuclear weapons in response to Western leaders. Moscow said the escalation is motivated by recent comments by French President Emmanuel Macron, who again refused to rule out sending French troops to Ukraine, as well as UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron, who said last week Ukraine could use British weapons inside Russia. NATO blasted Russia's move as irresponsible. In Tunisia, hundreds of refugees, including children and babies, are missing after police raided and dismantled several makeshift migrant tent camps in the capital, Tunis, over the weekend. It's believed the refugees, mostly from Sudan, were forcibly taken and abandoned in the desert near the border with Algeria. Some of the babies were born in Tunisia from refugee parents. One of the encampments had been built in an alleyway outside the UN's International Organization for Migration office as refugees pleaded for help. In Haiti, at least 17 people have been killed after days of torrential rains and floods. Some 4,000 homes have been submerged in water as Haitians are already struggling with a spiraling economic and security situation. Much of the destruction is centralized in Haiti's northern region. Residents remain on high alert.
We sleep badly and we eat badly. Everything is complicated. For example, when it rains, we can't sleep. We have to stay standing because water flows below us, so everybody stays standing. There's no way we can lie to rest.
And the judge overseeing Donald Trump's criminal 2016 election interference hush money case in New York fined Trump another $1,000 for his 10th violation of his gag order and threatened him with jail if he continues to violate the order. Trump's been barred from publicly speaking out about potential witnesses and members of the court or the New York District Attorney's Office. Judge Juan Merchan said, quote, "The last thing I want to do is put you in jail. You are the former president of the United States and possibly the next president as well," the judge said. But Merchan concluded, quote, "At the end of the day, I have a job to do," he said. On Monday, the 12th day of the trial, the court heard from two Trump Organization accounting employees who laid out the paper trail of hush money payments to Stormy Daniels via Trump's former fixer, attorney Michael Cohen, who is expected to testify. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined in Chicago by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Palestinians say nowhere is safe in Rafah as Israeli forces carried out heavy aerial bombardment again overnight and moved in with tanks, seizing the Rafah crossing on Gaza's border with Egypt. The Israeli military released video showing soldiers raising an Israeli flag near the Gaza side of the Rafah crossing and a tank running over an "I love Gaza" sign. Over a million Palestinians have fled to Rafah since October 7th. Israel's war cabinet voted to move forward with its Rafah military operation Monday, even after Hamas said it had accepted a ceasefire proposal. Israel says the proposal, which was developed with mediators from Qatar and Egypt, falls short of its demands. At one point, Al Jazeera reported people in Rafah started celebrating upon hearing the announcement that Hamas had accepted the Gaza ceasefire proposal. This is a displaced child in Gaza, Malak, responding to the news Monday.
We were optimistic when Hamas agreed to the ceasefire proposal. We were very optimistic. But Israel procrastinated, and it is going too far. They don't want to agree for ceasefire, and they want to raid. They dropped leaflets, and we don't know what to do or where to go.
Meanwhile, thousands of people rallied across Israel Monday night, calling for an immediate deal to release the hostages still held in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Monday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller responded to questions about Hamas accepting the Gaza ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar.
The last thing I would ever want to do from this podium is say something that could put this very sensitive process at greater risk. We are at a critical stage right now. We got a response from Hamas. Now Director Burns is working through that, trying to assess it, working with the Israelis. I mean, my goodness, folks, I don't know that it gets any more sensitive than right now. And the worst thing that we can do is start speculating about what's in it.
That's White House spokesperson John Kirby. In a statement today, Hamas called for international intervention to push Israel towards a ceasefire. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by former Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy. He's president of the U.S. Middle East Project, was an Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Daniel Levy. If you can talk about the latest that is understood about the ceasefire proposal, what Hamas has accepted, what Israel has refused to accept at this point, though they have sent a mid-level delegation to continue the negotiations.
With pleasure, Amy, as long as you let me just very quickly acknowledge that John Kirby and the White House have done very little from their podium except undermine the prospects of ending this war for the last months. So I think it's a little bit rich for the spokesperson, Mr. Kirby, to stand there and say the last thing I'd want to do is undermine it. You've done very little else for many, many months. If we are getting close, then why did you wait this long? Why have so many thousands of children died and suffered appallingly along with all of the Palestinian civilian population? And why have those hostage families had to wait so long? Now, what's going on? What has been proposed? What has been agreed? There is a document that has been leaked. I cannot speak to its veracity, but I understand that it is certainly close to the stand to be discussed. And there are two key components to this, Amy. One is this thing that we have been circling around for months now, which is, does a pause, a hostage release, a release of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli jails, does this represent the beginning of a sustained calm, a sustained ceasefire, an on-ramp to that permanent ceasefire? Or is this limited in time, duration, and then Israel continues to enter Rafah, carry out its assault on Gaza? If Hamas turned around and said, at the end of 40 days, we're going to launch rockets on southern Israel, I think people would say, well, that's a bit of a strange deal. But if Israel says at the end of 40 days, we're going to launch an assault on Rafah, then this is apparently a reasonable response. And that's the key thing. And I think what has happened this time around is that in addition to testing each other, the Hamas and Israeli parties are testing the United States of America and the Biden administration in an unprecedented way. What do I mean by that? I think we've come this far because Hamas detects that the U.S. may finally be serious about offering a sustained calm, about guaranteeing, but at least credibly guaranteeing, that they do not see a continuation of the war after 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 weeks. On the flip side, Prime Minister Netanyahu is testing, are the U.S. serious? Are they really going to hold off my weapons supplies? Are they really going to lay the blame at my door if I'm the recalcitrant party? Because that will be difficult for me to sustain domestically. We don't yet have the answer from the Biden administration in unequivocal terms. I think that will be crucial. That's the key question. Then, Amy, there are the details of the agreement, which will be hard to iron out. But if you've got this core question addressed of, are we really going to a ceasefire or are we going to a temporary pause? And unless it's the former, this can't be done. If we've got that ironed out, then one hopes that the questions around Palestinian movement inside Gaza, the questions around where the Israeli forces will be deployed, the questions around the entrance of humanitarian desperately needed assistance, one hopes that all those can be thrashed out. If we got there, then there's implementation. Implementation will be difficult, especially if Netanyahu feels he can get away with slipping out of this and going back to what he clearly prefers, which is an even longer war, because that's how his politics stacks up.
And Daniel Levy, the BBC is reporting that a senior Palestinian official familiar with the ceasefire is claiming that Hamas, quote, to end hostile activity forever if the conditions of the truce are met. Do you place any stock in that report or from what you're hearing?
I do not. Hamas is a political movement. It's an armed resistance movement. It has committed, I would argue, violations of international law. Israel was doing that before October 7th. So was Hamas. That has continued throughout this war. Hamas is also an idea in terms of resistance to permanent hostile belligerent occupation. I would take with extreme caution anything we're being told by a Palestinian authority source. They're simply not part of this because they have marginalized themselves by becoming part of the furniture of the Israeli occupation. Unfortunately, today, it's hard not to see them as a co-opted authority. One, I think it's important to acknowledge that alongside condemning what Hamas did on October 7th, one has to acknowledge that the Palestinians have the right under international law to resist an illegal occupation. They must simply do so within the parameters defined by international law, just as Israel has a right to defend its citizens. That's its responsibility. But again, it must do so within the parameters of international law, rather than violating, very plausibly, the Genocide Convention as set out by justice in its provisional ruling. So I would suggest that that kind of rumor mill is unhelpful.
And I wanted to ask you also about the protests, the continuing massive protests within Israel, even in, while the war continues. Your sense of the impact of these protests on the Israeli government?
It's a very important point, Juan. What I think we have seen is that the intensity of those protests, and those protests tend to center around the prioritizing of getting the hostages out, saying, do the deal, get the hostages out. The intensity, especially those led by members and family of those being held, by family, friends, those have increased. The volume, the extent to which this is disruptive and is impossible for Netanyahu to stare down, I do not think we are anywhere near that moment. And so you have to put these protests in the context of what is the internal dynamic in Israel? Is it a dynamic where Netanyahu feels he's run out of options? So there's a way of interpreting what's happening at the moment is that Israel has started, especially at the border crossing with Egypt, seizing a part of Rafah, a part of this area called the Philadelphia Corridor as well, as a last gasp thing. So the government, which feels it will have to agree to a deal, will be able to say, you see, it was this action which got them to accept slightly better terms. We did what we needed to do. That is the optimistic interpretation, that the pressure internally and externally is such that Netanyahu feels it's closing in on him. I do not think we're there yet. I'm not with that interpretation. I would like us to be there. The internal pressure is such that the soft opposition, who will run against Netanyahu in the next election, led by this guy Gantz, former chief of staff, former defense minister, and Eisenkot, they are still in the government. They have still not unequivocally said that if Netanyahu turns down the deal, they will quit. Even if they quit, Netanyahu has a majority. The street protests, courage to them, they're important. You even had, it was Holocaust Remembrance Day yesterday, you even had Holocaust survivors coming out and saying, not in our name, this isn't how one goes about remembering the Holocaust. And Netanyahu used this, as he has done throughout, in very scurrilous terms. But the pressure does not feel sufficient that Netanyahu's politics needs him to accept a ceasefire. He still thinks he can wiggle out of this, which is where the question of the external pressure becomes a key factor, because it's going to be that combination of internal and external. So I think the next question one would have to address is, where does the external pressure stand?
I wanted to go to another clip, this of U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
So I can confirm that Hamas has issued a response. We are reviewing that response now and discussing it with our partners in the region. As you know, Director Burns is in the region working on this in real time. We'll be discussing this response with our partners over the coming hours. We continue to believe that a hostage deal is in the best interests of the Israeli people. It's in the best interests of the Palestinian people. It would bring an immediate ceasefire. It would allow increased movement of humanitarian assistance, and so we're going to continue to work to try to reach one.
And so if you can talk, he's referring to the CIA director, Burns, who is intimately involved with these negotiations. He's going back and forth. If you can talk about his significance. And when you talked about the role of the United States, how exactly has it stopped this from happening to this point, Daniel Levy?
Yes, I wish I could confirm that the U.S. has stopped this from happening. I mean, firstly, Amy, let's just go back to those scenes you showed earlier on. Palestinians in Gaza celebrating when the news came through of the Hamas acceptance of the terms of a deal. I think one can understand their celebrations, not only, of course, because of what they've been going through, but also they have been told, if anyone takes the United States government seriously, they have been telling us, Blinken said this in his last visit, they have been telling us that all it takes is a Hamas yes. So I think many of us would have been reasonable in responding, well, we got a Hamas yes, it's all done and dusted, isn't it? The reason that's not quite true is this was, I think one has to acknowledge, misinformation on the part of the US government, that this doesn't just depend on Hamas, it very clearly depends on the Israeli side, which I think most of the Israeli commentators at this stage are acknowledging, that Prime Minister Netanyahu has constantly undermined these talks. And rather than being pulled up on this, being held with his feet to the fire by the US administration, have failed to do that. Now, I think it matters that CIA Director Burns is still in the region, we understand, is directly engaged. Blinken has really not done a good job of this. I understand they play different roles. But one has to really ask this question, because that's the outside pressure. Will the US make it as near as impossible for Netanyahu to say no? If they fail that test, then Rafah will happen. By the way, it will almost certainly still be going on when Democrats convene for their convention in Chicago. I am not suggesting, and I think this is an important distinction to draw, Amy, I am not suggesting that the administration can click their finger and stop this. What I am saying is that a US administration that is willing to sustain a standoff with the Israeli leadership will place Netanyahu in a position where his military are saying, we just can't keep going with this. You already have burnout. Rafah will not be easy. The military side of this has not gone well. You will have a population increasingly saying, this is too much to put at risk, this relationship. And Netanyahu will have the hardest choice to make. And I think over time, he will have to succumb to this. There have been reports that some of the weapons transfers have been held up from the US to Israel by the administration. Those have neither been confirmed nor denied. If you want to get a ceasefire, they're going to have to be confirmed. That is actually going to have to happen. I imagine that some of this move towards a possible deal, move towards possible US seriousness in challenging Netanyahu, that we are not at the point of success yet. But some of the move towards that is a consequence of what you've shown us, what's going on inside the US, the pressure, the campuses. People should not feel disheartened. What they are doing is having an impact. The fear of how this could play out politically. And so I would say in these crucial moments, those efforts should be redoubled because they are meaningful.
And Daniel Levy, I'm wondering, the of the Israeli cabinet to urge Palestinians, 100,000 Palestinians, to leave eastern Rafah. Do you sense that this is also an attempt by Netanyahu to short-circuit a potential deal?
I would interpret it that way, yes, Juan. There are two ways people are looking at this. Is this a smart negotiating tactic to gain more leverage? I don't think that's worked with Hamas thus far. I see no reason to think that was the case. Hamas had already submitted its responses. The other way of looking at this is that it's a way of testing, prodding, can Israel get away with this? Can this prove to Hamas that we can do it, we are going to do it, there is no deal, and therefore Hamas will retreat from its position? I think that is a more reasonable